In Shakespeare's The Tempest, Prospero, the rightful Duke of Milan, tells his daughter Miranda the tale of how his brother, Antonio, usurped his title and put the two of them in a leaky boat to perish at sea. Instead, by providence divine, they landed on an island. There Prospero became a great and powerful magician, able even to control the wind and the sea. As a fleet of ships passes by, he conjures a storm and brings Antonio and his other enemies to his island and into his power. The story of what happens next is the topic of Wyoming Catholic College President Glenn Arbery's lecture on The Tempest at the 2017 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. Here is that lecture in its entirety.
This play is, like King Lear and Hamlet, a kind of prophetic witness to the momentous passage that the men and women of the time feel themselves undergoing. And it shares many themes with the tragedies, usurpation and betrayal in particular, like King Lear or Hamlet. Like King Lear, it also has its radical contrast and its portrayals of men. In this play, for example, Prospero and Caliban. Caliban is the native of the island, so to speak. I mean, his mother was the first settler there. But he's the slave of Caliban, which is itself kind of problematic. But these contrasts in the high and noble and the savage seem to arise from the preoccupations of the age. On the one hand, Renaissance man once again has the high stature that he enjoyed in Sophocles' Ode to Man or in Praxiteles' statues. On the other hand, you get the discoveries in the New World, which have for the past century or so put unaccommodated man, as Lear calls him, before the European imagination. Men like Caliban, Prospero's slave, whose name recalls the cannibals of Montaigne's famous essay, and who is at least symbolically a native of the New World. The encounter with savages, as opposed to, say, country bumpkins, right, guys who just don't know much, reopened all kinds of questions about the nature of human institutions and also about the responsible use of power. The discovery of America in the Americans was paralleled by new mathematical theories of the heavens, such as those of Kepler and Galileo, an unsettling new view of the cosmos that called the accepted meaning of man into profound doubt. A famous passage in John Donne's long poem, An Anatomy of the World, which was also published in 1611, expresses the concerns of the age. The new philosophy calls all in doubt. The element of fire is quite put out. The sun is lost, and the earth, and no man's wit can well direct him where to look for it. And freely men confess that this world's spent, when in the planets and the firmament they seek so many new. They see that this is crumbled out again to his atomies. 'Tis all in pieces, all coherence gone, all just supply and all relation. Prince, subject, father, son are things forgot. For every man alone thinks he has got to be a phoenix that then can be none of that kind of which he is but he. In other words, right, there's no human nature. It's just everybody is his own person, everybody's his own being, and everybody starts from scratch. So the four elements of the classical and medieval world, earth, air, fire, and water, have already been challenged by a new atomism in such thinkers as Francis Bacon. The new astronomical theories have lost the sun and the earth, which no longer move where they used to move. The formerly fixed heavens, which were for several millennia the paradigm of orderly perfection, have become newly unfixed, and new stars keep coming into view, a process that telescopes make possible. And Galileo and Kepler have already begun using these by 1611. This unfixing of the heavens is especially significant. The French philosopher Remy Brogue points out in his book, The Wisdom of the World, that, quote, a gulf separates the ancients and the moderns. The ancients could appeal and refer to the supralunary, that is, the heavens above the moon, to show that in the overwhelming majority of cases, nature is governed by the good. For us, on the other hand, that path has become a dead end. We no longer recognize the distinction between the sublunary and supralunary domains. In other words, Brog says that the universe, as we now use it to cover the totality of things, replaces the word world, which just gets demoted to mean an inhabited realm. For us, writes Brog, the universe is a totality, a seamless garment. We no longer have the right to differentiate between levels of the world that would have more or less value. I hope that point's clear. In other words, when there was a supralunary universe world, it was fixed, it was permanent, you saw the relations, and you could count on those to be a kind of image of the good. Whereas for us, it's all of a piece. Everything is subject to becoming and to change. And so this is a pretty radical shift in things. For the ancients and for Dante, the moral order had a cosmological basis. The world itself was divided into the changeable sphere beneath the moon and the unchanging heavens above the moon. But as this known cosmos is crumbled out again to its atoms, as Dunn puts it, the patterns of order that it once sustained by analogy also begin to crumble. All felt coherence is gone. You know, this way that you feel the world. Reason, which was once analogous to the realm above the changeable moon, no longer has the same cosmically supported supremacy over appetite. All meaningful relation between a higher order of being and a lower one begins to give way. And this problem begins to show up in politics, in families, and in this new individualism. There's a kind of way that authority and the analogies for authority begin to be undercut. Prince, subject, father, son, are things forgot, says Dunn. And once there's no difference in standing or degree in terms of greater or less authority, then love cools, as Gloucester says in King Lear. Friendship falls off, brothers divide, in cities, mutinies, in countries, discord, in palaces, treason, and the bond cracked twixt son and father. In Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida, has anybody ever heard of this play, much less read it? A few of you heard of it, right, yeah.
What was the name again?
Troilus and Cressida. It's a play that I think is rarely performed. And once you read it, you say, well, for good reason. it's kind of an ugly play, particularly if you love the Iliad and Greek things. It's a pretty low view of the Trojan War. But in any case, there's a speech in this play when Ulysses is analyzing this loss of hierarchy or degree. And he really pushes the point. Take but degree away. Now, you substitute the word authority or hierarchy for degree, and you kind of see better what it is that Ulysses is saying. Take but degree away, untune that string, and hark what discord follows. Force should be right, or rather, right and wrong, between whose endless jar justice resides, should lose their names. And so should justice too. Then everything includes itself in power. Power into will into appetite, an appetite, an universal wolf, so doubly seconded with will and power, must make perforce an universal prey, and last eat up himself. Sort of reminded of what Dr. Kaczynski was saying in the seminar a couple of days ago about, you know, power and Foucault and the postmoderns. It's like that's the only basis of things. Words change their meanings. There are no universal, realities to which you can point. It all is subject to who has the power. Justice won't be a universal that, in a sense, measures even God, but whatever the stronger decides it is. Right and wrong won't be measures of action, but mere words at the mercy of those who have the power to define them. Shakespeare gives us a number of characters who think of morality and justice as functions of power. Very much like some of the characters in Plato's Republic early on, you know, Thrasymachus or Glaucon even think of justice in these ways. The bastard son in King Lear, for example, rejects the influence of the heavens and instead considers everything in terms of what Machiavelli calls the effectual truth, doing what works in terms of power, instead of looking to any kind of ideal. And doing what works is usually self-serving, as it is, as you saw last night, for Hempf and Grubitz, right? Or in this play, Prospero's brother, Antonio, the usurper of his dukedom. So it seems to me that for Shakespeare, the big question is how to respond to this abuse of power. Shakespeare pretty clearly anticipates Romano Guardini's analysis in our reading for this afternoon, where Guardini writes that recent years have been marked by a monstrous growth in man's power over being, over things and men. But the grave responsibility, the clear consciousness, the strong character needed for exercising this power, have not kept pace with its growth. So Guardini is thinking here about 20th century things, particularly 20th century technology, including, say, the atomic bomb, powers of surveillance, right, in Nazi Germany and so on. But Shakespeare already has the problem of European power clearly in view in 1611, especially in this play. There's both an increasing power over nature and also power over less civilized nations, less educated, less technologically advanced, who come into the care of modern European man. Prospero, the central figure of The Tempest, is a figure of such power, such an incredible amount of power when we see him in this play, that all these issues of what you're going to do with power come right to the fore. The power he holds is so great that it's difficult to imagine him ever being the victim of a plot that removed him from office. He must have really not been paying attention, right? But as he tells his daughter Miranda in the portion of the play that you read, back in Milan, that's how you say it in this play, he had left the practical management of his dukedom to his brother while he devoted himself, like other great figures in the heady days of the Italian Renaissance, when so many ancient texts were being discovered, he devoted himself to closeness and the bettering of his mind. And he was no ordinary student, but a man known to be without a parallel in the liberal arts. So paying too little attention to the politics of Milan, he was sort of in the exact opposite of the situation of Dante, as Dr. Baxter pointed it out yesterday. Dante was so taken up with politics that he neglected his poetry, right? That was his real end. But like Dante, Prospero found that the circumstances of his exile ironically brought about the occasion to develop his gifts in a way that might not otherwise have happened. You see what I'm saying? Had he remained in Milan and stuck to his studies, there are powers that he would have had no occasion to develop, especially those that we'll get into of magic. But put out to sea with his daughter, he came to the island he now occupies, as he says, by providence divine. I think that's important to note. There are two uses of providence in this play, and this is one of them. When Miranda asked him, well, how did we get here? There were no sails on the ship. You know, they were really put out there to die. Gonzalo is the kind old Neapolitan who puts food and water and Prospero's books in this little boat that they're abandoned in. And Prospero says that they arrive at the island by providence divine. Here he found the spirit Ariel imprisoned in a tree. He released him, but continues to exact services from him with the promise of liberty. And he also found the savage Caliban, whom he tried to educate until Caliban tried to rape Miranda. From Duke of Milan, he becomes the ruler of a primitive island, which is, you know, more or less anticipating Robinson Crusoe. It's kind of the same scenario, right? That is also a green world in the critic Northrop Frye's sense, a comic place away from the city where wrongs are righted and order restored. It's like the woods in Midsummer Night's Dream, or As You Like It, you know, other Shakespeare plays have similar spaces. He lives with Miranda in a full poor cell. His place he lives is always referred to as a cell. You think maybe it's a cave, but I mean, why this word cell, which seems to have more or less monastic associations with it? We find, however, that, you know, despite the sort of poverty of his circumstances, nobody else in Shakespeare even approaches Prospero's power. I can't think of a single figure, even Oberon, you know, in Midsummer Night's Dream, or figures like that, who really approach the kind of power that Prospero has. It's paternal, it's political, it's religious, but most of all, it's this potent art of magic that he possesses. So we can ask of him what the disciples ask of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke when he calms the storm. And this is a little unsettling. What manner of man is this? For he commands even the winds and water, and they obey him. The comparison, as I say, has to make us uneasy, and I think it's supposed to. Prospero's art rouses the violent tempest that begins the play. 12 years after his dukedom was usurped by his brother Antonio, who was in collusion with Alonso, the king of Naples, his enemies are sailing close to the island. Using the powers of Ariel, Prospero wrecks the ship, forces them all ashore, where Ariel divides them into separate parties, making Alonso and his son Ferdinand each believe that the other is drowned. With the help of Ariel, he manipulates the perceptions of them all and puts them in situations that show their true characters, as I'll get back to later. By the end of the play, they're all completely at his mercy. And the question is what he'll do now that all of them are in his care. Does he have what Guardini calls the grave responsibility, the clear consciousness, the strong character needed for exercising this power? So let's take a few minutes to think about the nature of this power that he exercises, this rough magic, because it seems to me that Shakespeare is showing us something about a new use of power that's going to characterize the modern world, and at the same time he's showing us a way to combat its irresponsible use. So what do we see in Prospero? The first thing, it seems to me, is knowledge in the traditional sense. This is a very learned man, right? To put it in the context of what we've been reading this week, he's the philosophic man. He's seen true beauty, and he can't be swayed by lesser sights. He's ascended from the cave. But earlier in his life, he was so delighted with the life of the true world that he can no longer read or even notice the shadows on the wall, if you see what I'm saying. Back in Milan, where he was duke and cast the government upon his brother, he was famous as a scholar for the liberal arts without a parallel, those being all my study. And transported and wrapped as he was in his secret studies, he neglected his duties as a governor and apparently did not have enough prescience or insight into human nature to anticipate his brother's betrayal. Precisely because he became so enamored with wisdom, Prospero unwisely lost his rightful place as duke. In this usurpation, it seems to me that Shakespeare is symbolizing the displacement of a higher and nobler order by a crass, power-hungry, and irresponsible one. So if you think of this as a kind of shift in the age, this is the real danger. You're going from an older order that's kind of rooted in authority, right? The inherited kingship, the offices of church and state, to one that seems much more up for grabs and determined by power. And this seems to me the central threat that the play addresses. Is the higher order capable of defending itself? Can it exercise enough power to secure its place without giving away its essential danger? You follow me? In other words, if it's necessary to begin to think like the enemy, at what point do you begin to concede, you know, the very nature of what you're trying to protect to the one against whom you're protecting it? So this question, seems to me, becomes Prospero's whole study. Philosophy per se might make him capable of being the philosopher king who is the best ruler, but it won't give him the power to return from exile and exercise effective rule. So his power lies in his magic, most prominent feature of who he is on the island. Now I want to emphasize that this is on the island, right? He wasn't a magus when he was in Milan, right? And at the end of the play, he's on the verge of giving up his power. But during the action of the play, this is who Prospero is, right? This magus, this man who commands the spirits. The other famous play of Shakespeare's day that centers on magic is Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, about the learned man who sells his soul to the devil in return for magical powers. Prospero has no such bargain, so how do we understand his magic? And you remember when I was talking about Milton on Sunday night, I mentioned Pico della Mirandola, you know, has that kind of high vision of man, almost unfallen. He can choose whatever destiny he wants. In this same oration, which was published in 1496, Thomas More loved it. You know, this is, you know, good, almost 125 years before Shakespeare's play. Anyway, Pico argues that magic has two forms. One consists wholly in the operations and powers of demons, and consequently this appears to me an execrable and monstrous thing. The other proves, when thoroughly investigated, to be nothing else but the highest realization of natural philosophy. This beneficent magic, in calling forth, as it were, from their hiding places into the light, the powers which the largesse of God has sown and planted in the world, does not itself work miracles so much as sedulously serve nature as she works her wonders. As the farmer weds his elms to the vines, so the magus unites earth to heaven, that is, the lower orders to the endowments and powers of the higher. So, Pico, this benevolent magic, in other words, doesn't draw upon demonic powers, but on nature herself, say the mysteries of electricity, which would certainly be considered magical 4 centuries ago, right? Shakespeare's contemporary Francis Bacon, one of the architects of the scientific age, might, along with Pico, contribute to Shakespeare's depiction of Prospero. According to the scholar Graham Rees, for Bacon, magic is classified as applied science. It is never identified with black magic, since it represents the ultimate legitimate power over nature. For Bacon, knowledge is power, and this magic is the knowledge of nature's secrets in order to transform them into operations, that is, to do something with these secrets, right? Not just know them, but do something with them. Bacon calls knowledge a rich storehouse for the glory of the Creator and, even more importantly, for the relief of man's estate, right? So all these things are going to help us live in the world the more we understand how to master them. Anyway, as far as we can tell from the play itself, Prospero's books give him power. Notice the emphasis on books. There's a film by Peter Greenaway called Prospero's Books that really puts all the focus on the actual, you know, books themselves. But the books, the staff, the cloak, these seem to be the accoutrements of his magic. And the books are a little puzzling if we're trying to think of Prospero next to Bacon. Because if he were purely modern, he'd reject all the old books, right? They contain only the wisdom of the old order, and he'd concentrate on method and experimentation and discovering what's been hidden before. The presence of these books implies that what Prospero learns has been known before, written before, in which case we wonder what it means that he drowns his book at the end. You know, something we'll need to think about in the seminar. It's almost as though it were too dangerous to be allowed to survive. The main control he exerts, perhaps through what his book teaches him, is over Ariel, who has experienced the difference between black magic and beneficent magic. Ariel has a debt of gratitude to Prospero for releasing him from the cloven pine where the foul witch Sycorax had confined him because he was a spirit too delicate to act her earthy and abhorred commands, refusing her grand hests. So Sycorax pins him in the pine tree. When Prospero first came to the island, he heard the groans that made wolves howl and penetrated the breast of angry bears. And he liberated Ariel, who had been bound there by help of Sycorax's more potent ministers. Prospero's work, in other words, takes place in the same sphere as the witchcraft of Sycorax, but it's far greater. As he tells Ariel, "It was mine art, when I arrived and heard thee, that made gape the pine and let thee out." Caliban himself says that his art, that is Prospero's art, is of such power it would control my dam's god, Setebos, and make a vassal of him. He now possesses an art, in other words, capable of controlling the spirits that have power over natural phenomena, and the tempest at the beginning of the play is the overwhelming evidence of this. This power doesn't seem Baconian, right? So this isn't applied science. It's theurgic, you know, it calls spirits up, it's grand, it has a kind of primordial feel to it. Elsewhere in Shakespeare, a storm reflects some elemental sympathy with disorder in the human sphere. For example, there's a great storm in the middle of King Lear, when King Lear has been cast out by his daughters, you know, he's wandering out through the heath. It's as though the violation of natural duty and Lear's rejection by his daughters had summoned these impetuous blasts and the to and fro conflicting wind and rain. In Othello, a great storm destroys the Turkish fleet. And Othello, when he's interpreting it, says that God himself forbids the Ottoman Turks to attack Cyprus. In both cases, the natural world appears to respond to some disturbance in the human order. But the storm and the tempest is clearly caused by Prospero's art, not by some sympathy in nature, though the opportunity for its exercise had to be brought about by an alignment of circumstances not in his control. This is that moment, that, you know, providential moment. As Prospero tells Miranda, "By accident most strange, bountiful fortune, now, my dear lady, hath mine enemies brought to this shore. And by my prescience, I find my zenith doth depend upon a most auspicious star, whose influence, if now I court not, my fortunes will ever after droop." There's this one moment. If you take advantage of it, things go well. If you lose it, that's it, right? Things are ever after gonna. Isn't there a passage in Julius Caesar or somewhere to much the same? Right, right, that, you know, right, yeah, this is the same idea, right? There's that one moment when you can really take advantage of it and things, you know, go in a certain way. So this is, you know, as in Bebet's Feast, right, a chirotic moment, a portal, an opening in the weave, and his own zenith or height defends upon taking advantage of it. The occasion that bountiful fortune presents to Prospero, by accident most strange, is the marriage of Alonso's daughter, Claribel, to the king of Tunis. This is why Alonso is out at sea. He's coming back from Africa, where he's just married his daughter to the king of Tunis. Interestingly, a marriage between Europe and Africa, right? And it calls up associations in the play with Dido, right, with Aeneas. So it's something about a kind of an attempt to unify things on a larger scale. But this brings the fleet close to his island on their return from Naples. What this means to those critics these days who say that this is all about the New World, right? You see, I mean, it can't literally be the New World. It's got to be between Tunis and Italy, you see. But the associations, you know, are pretty clearly there with Caliban. In any case, Ariel scatters the ships and brings Alonso himself, along with Antonio, directly into Prospero's power. When Ariel is reporting on his work, he tells Prospero that the king's ship is safely in harbor. For the rest of the fleet, which I dispersed, they have all met again and are upon the Mediterranean float, bound sadly home for Naples, supposing that they saw the king's ship wrecked and his great person perish. So compared to the storms in King Lear or Othello, what is Prospero's tempest? The effects of it are clearly real. The wild winds, I mean, if you're reading the first, you know, if you opened the book at the beginning, the wild winds, the thunder and lightning, the waves that swamp the ship. From the first lines of the play, the master and the boatswain try to keep the ship from being blown into the lee shore. The boatswain ignores the political and social superiority of his passengers. He's got the king of Naples and so on board, and tells them to stay below. You mar our labor. Keep your cabins. You do assist the storm. When Gonzalo tries to get him to respect the king's position, the boatswain shouts, "What cares these roarers for the name of king? To cabin, silence, trouble us not." When Gonzalo keeps after him, he says, "You're a counselor. If you can command these elements to silence and work the peace of the present, we will not hand a rope more. Use your authority." In a storm, the most experienced and knowledgeable person should obviously steer the ship. In the Republic, Socrates uses the ship analogy to describe the city and the necessity of a pilot, a philosopher perhaps, right, who knows the true ends of human life and can steer accordingly. Prospero creates the storm, in other words, to raise the natural question of who should be in charge. The king of Naples? Not unless he can command these elements to silence. All through this opening scene, there's an irony here that's not revealed until the next scene with Miranda. Prospero, the dupe and bookworm who was removed from office in Milan by his brother Antonio, can in fact command these elements to silence and work the peace of the present. By his potent magic, he commands not just the ship, but even the storm that besets the ship. His parallel, in other words, is not only to the good pilot of the political ship, the wise philosopher king who sees how to navigate the city through the tempest of fortune, but also to the god who sends the storm itself to try its victims and sometimes to destroy them. So this storm, it's the supreme manifestation of Prospero's magical power, both over nature and over those less educated and less capable. And it brings the enemies who once overthrew him, as I've said, into his control. It's not a real storm in the same sense that the storm in Lear is real. Follow? We know Prospero made it, so it's not real. But it's certainly experienced as a real storm, even though its phenomena and its effects on those who suffer through it all derive from the intentions of Prospero. Miranda, watching it from the shore and horrified at the sight of the ship dashed all to pieces, suspects that Prospero is responsible for it. "If by your art, my dearest father, you have put the wild waters in this roar, allay them. Poor souls, they perished. Had I been any god of power, I would have sunk the sea within the earth, or ere it should the good ship so have swallowed and the frauding souls within her." Prospero says, "Be collected. No more amazement. Tell your piteous heart there's no harm done." Had I been any god of power, she says, she would have done something to avert this calamity, so why didn't Prospero? Perhaps without meaning to, she gives us the proper term for Prospero, a god of power, because of his art. Why doesn't he sink the sea within the earth instead of letting this happen? In the play, the answer is clear, because there is no harm done. And this answer has a great deal to do with the other dimension of power that Shakespeare explores in this play. In other words, if philosophy gives Prospero a wisdom, and magic gives him power over nature through the spirits he commands, what do we make of the other art in the play, the magic that continues exactly as long as the play lasts? I said a minute ago that Prospero's Tempest isn't a real storm, but at the beginning of the play, we don't know that. Why wouldn't we accept the storm as a real storm? As readers or as the audience in the theater, we know when the play begins that we are in a play, right? We know that it's a deliberate fiction whose aim is to allow us to participate in an imagined action that we expect to do something to us or for us, to get us out of ourselves, amuse us, teach us. When this play begins, the playwright imagines a great tempest, and the first scene plunges us into it. If we're in the theater, then whatever theatrical devices the stage, Shakespearean stage uses to create the effects of storms, striking a metal sheet, right, or rolling a cannonball, are brought into action. Claps of thunder, flashes of lightning. The actors on stage lean into an imagined wind that whips the imagined rain into their faces. They pull on ropes. They shout above the clamor of the sound effects, and we happily accept the storm as a real storm. As one commentator puts it, men running, shouting, cursing, master and bosun bawling orders, canvas banging with loud reports, wind whistling, lightning and St. Elmo's light, and all that a competent stage manager can adventitiously supply from the wings. So again, why wouldn't we accept this storm as a real storm? But then, the play itself reveals that the storm was brought about by art. Literally, of course, we already knew that. We know it's a play. And yet, we didn't know it in the play. Are you with me? All right. We gave ourselves over to the fiction, and we thought it was the play. When Ariel says that the tempest damaged nothing, not a hair perished on their sustaining garments, not a blemish, but fresher than before, we see that in the play, it was a magical storm, playing on the sense that it was sort of theatrical. Despite being magical or theatrical, it has emotional and moral effects that do not coincide with its physical effects. King Alonso thinks that he's lost his son. Ferdinand, on his odd angle of the aisle, thinks that he has lost his father. Prospero's art, his power over nature then, is, as many have pointed out, like the playwright's art, with its power over the imagination, except that those who fall under the spell of Prospero's art do not realize that they're in a play. You see what I'm saying? They do not know, and perhaps will never know, that all the real disorienting dangers that they experience are in fact matters of intentional art brought about through the magical power and prescience of Prospero. There's a scene in King Lear when the old blind Gloucester, how many of y'all know that play? A few of you? Yeah. So, you know, King Lear is about the old king who gives away his kingdom to his three daughters and ends up banishing the best one, and the tragic results of this. But there's a scene when old blind Gloucester has fallen into such despair that he wants to throw himself from the cliffs of Dover. But his son Edgar, who's still disguised from his father, devises a kind of play, and he does what actors in plays do to make his father imagine a scene. He pretends to walk uphill. Oh, this is steep, huh? His father's going, oh, it's not that bad, you know. He pretends, you know, he's speaking to his father who's blind. He pretends to look down over the edge of the cliffs at Dover and see the fishermen on the beach far below like beetles. And he describes this man hanging halfway down, gathering samphire, which is this, you know, herb that grows on the cliffs. Dreadful trade. It's sort of like being a window washer on a skyscraper, right? Is that feeling? He says that this far up, we cannot hear the murmuring surge that on the unnumbered idle pebbles chase. Listen to the line. So at the same time, he makes us hear, just listen to that wash and withdrawal, right? And as a result, it's almost impossible not to think, as blind Gloucester does, that he's at the edge of the cliff. So instead of falling from the cliff, when he hurls himself forward, Gloucester falls flat on his face. There's no harm done, right? Just as Prospero says to Miranda. Edgar then pretends to be someone on the beach who saw him fall from the cliff. He manufactures the story of Gloucester's amazing survival. Wow, I never saw anybody fall that far and not get hurt. And in doing so, he changes his father's disposition from despair to a kind of patient hope, right? He's not going to try to kill himself again. The fiction of the miracle brings about real moral change. Now, almost the whole of The Tempest is like that scene from King Lear. We're aware of the magician playwright at every point shaping the action, as Edgar does. Prospero is a god of power, and even though he does not give the other characters their lines, he can control whether they're awake or asleep. Whether they see strange sights or hear uncanny music, and so on. Each character responds to the conditions that Prospero creates, but each speaks out of his own character and inclinations. Shipwrecked on this desert island, the king grieves over the loss of his son. Gonzalo charitably tries to console the king. Antonio and Sebastian cynically make a joke of everything, etc. Meanwhile, elsewhere on the island, Ferdinand falls in love with Miranda, who first appears to him almost as a goddess. Miranda instantly falls in love with Ferdinand, and so on. All of these matters very carefully arranged by Prospero. The fact that Shakespeare's play contains and shows us Prospero's play, if I can call it that, does not mean that Shakespeare is superior to Prospero, though they're closely related. Prospero can do in nature what Shakespeare can do only on the stage. Prospero has mastered his magic so thoroughly that he is the god of power that man may become in his mastery of knowledge in the modern age. But in his power over others, he comes up against the old questions of justice and mercy, revenge and forgiveness, right and wrong, that inform both the real world and any fictional world made from it. The Tempest is about the way of rightly conceiving of power in the new age of human mastery over nature that's just coming into being. It's about how to use art in the service of the good, which must be chosen freely. The question is power. What will be done with this godlike power? Shakespeare seems to anticipate not only control of physical circumstances through power over nature, but also those who gain mastery over the thought of others with propaganda. Prospero serves freedom, but he doesn't denounce power per se or draw back from its use. I think this is very important to see. In fact, he masters magic in order to be able to overpower his enemies. But he exercises his art in order to bring them to see their sins and to give them the occasion to repent out of their own freedom. A victim of his brother's machinations, he could simply act on his appetite for revenge, but he doesn't. He works instead for the good, and his power ends with the play. I think because Prospero exists only as and through Shakespeare's art. So Prospero is greater than Shakespeare, but he exists only through Shakespeare's art. I'm going to leave the end of the play for the seminars. I suggest that we just read through it in its entirety. But in concluding, let me turn for a moment to what strikes me as the most problematic use of Prospero's power. He obviously wants Miranda, this beloved daughter that he's privately tutored since infancy, and he's the greatest mind in Europe, this girl who strikes us as superbly beautiful and gifted. He wants her to marry exactly the right person. The true reason for the tempest, the supreme effect of Prospero's auspicious star, and the true aim of all his art is the marriage of Ferdinand and Miranda. The prince is led to Miranda by Ariel's uncanny music. He sees her in the first disorienting moment of the loss of his father. But this threshold moment is also his first real experience of freedom. If he thought his father were alive, he'd feel constrained in the same way that most princes do. As Laertes says of Hamlet, he may not, as unvalued persons do, carve for himself, for on his choice depends the safety and health of this whole state. Right? Who you marry isn't a matter of indifference, but of immense political importance. But with his father dead, or so he thinks, he has nothing to prevent his heart from giving way to this miraculous consolation. For her part, Miranda sees the first man, other than her father and Caliban, that she's ever seen. And she finds him as unspeakably noble as he finds her beautiful. Prospero's zenith depends on the innate capacity for love in each of them suddenly taking hold when they see each other for the first time. And it does, right, to his immense gratification. And then he deliberately makes the courtship difficult. He makes Ferdinand haul firewood, which seems in Shakespeare to be the worst of all punishment. You see it several times, you know. Having to do it all winter myself, I guess I understand a lot. But anyway, simply, anyway. Okay, so he doesn't want Ferdinand to think that Miranda is undervalued, you know, because he won her heart so easily. But at the very least, don't we have to say that Prospero manipulates his own daughter here as much as he does Alonso, Antonio, and Sebastian? Doesn't it color our understanding a little to see that Prospero wants this marriage not only for her happiness, but also for the political alliance with Naples that Milan will make through her? Can this really be love? Well, of course it can, right? I think it is. But, and it's real in the same way that Alonso's repentance is real, as we'll see, you know, at the end of the play. But even if we say so, we have to say that this use of art has something troubling in it, something that's problematic. We want this marriage, but we also recognize that the uses of this kind of power require extraordinary wisdom and discernment, precisely because they impinge on freedom. As God says in Paradise Lost, "Not free, what proof could they have given sincere of true allegiance, constant faith, or love, where only what they needs must do appeared, not what they would." No wonder Prospero drowns his book. In this magus, as our mentor Donald Collin suggested long ago, Shakespeare gives us a figure who sees into the greatest dangers of modern power and acts to counter them with ancient wisdom and with all the powers of art. So what does it mean at the end of the play that Prospero becomes, in effect, the actor who plays Prospero and stands alone on the stage? He says, "All my charms are now o'erthrown," etc. "Now 'tis true, I must be here confined by you, or sent to Naples. Let me not, since I have my dukedom got, and pardon the deceiver, dwell in this bare island by your spell. Don't hold me in this role, in effect, but release me from my bands with the help of your good hands." The responsibility, this is what I want to get at, the responsibility for his return from exile rests somehow with us. His last appeal as he strips away his art is to us. "Now I want spirits to enforce, art to enchant, and my ending is despair unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free." So the power is entirely given over here. Prospero doesn't have it. We have it. Is he asking us to forgive the power he holds over us with his art, even if those greater powers of art are the necessary way? Is he asking us to forgive the solution of power that he's shown us? I think that's a question we can take to the seminars. Okay, thank you.
If you've enjoyed these lectures from the 2017 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, let me encourage you to save the dates for the 2018 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. We would love to have you join us here in Lander, Wyoming, June 10 to 14, 2018, where our topic will be The Paradox of Courage, Desire to Live, Readiness to Die. Why not make the week part of a Wyoming vacation for your whole family next summer? For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.